Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll have an interview with State Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow about the 2013 legislative session, which just wrapped up yesterday. But first, we have this news. The Federal Aviation Administration says the closure of air traffic control towers at 149 small airports nationwide can be delayed until June 15th. The towers were scheduled to close during the next 2 months due to the federal budget sequestration. The control tower at the Lewiston-Nez Perce County Airport was scheduled to close May 5th. The FAA says the shutdowns will occur on June 15th unless local entities can find funding to pay to keep the towers open. Other airports affected in Idaho include Idaho Falls, Pocatello, and Freedman Memorial Airport in Haley. The FAA says the closures won't affect air safety and expects all other operations at the affected airports to continue. The FAA says it has used 30-year-old air safety data to justify keeping the control towers open, but more recent data on accident rates show there isn't a need to keep them open. Each control tower costs about $500,000 per year to operate. Currently, only 10% of the nation's 5,000 public airports have control towers, and those are generally the ones with the most air traffic. Pilots flying into less used airports coordinate landings and takeoffs by radio amongst themselves. Mountain snowpack in Washington state is 112% of normal at the end of the winter, which is the wettest in the West this winter. By comparison, Arizona appears to be entering into a serious drought with only 40% average snowpack in its mountains. The highest snowpack levels for Washington are in the Olympic Peninsula with 130% of normal. Snowpack in the Blue Mountains in the southeastern part of the state is 85% of normal. Republican U.S. Representative Doc Hastings of Central Washington has told the Yakima Herald Republic the National Security Agency plans to close its listening post near Yakima. The activities of the electronic eavesdropping station, which has been in operation since the 1970s, are mostly classified, but the station has been associated with the National Security Agency's global surveillance network called Echelon. Under Echelon, listening posts around the world have for decades intercepted wholesale satellite traffic, including pre-internet phone calls and texts, and then filtered the information for keywords of interest. NSA spokesperson Neil Kirby told the Herald Republic the closure is part of the agency's effort to streamline and reorganize its operations. Kirby said some of the surveillance functions will be moved to Colorado. Kirby would not say how many employees work at the station near Yakima because that information is classified. He also said an exact closing date is not available. The listening station is located on steppe land on the U.S. Army Yakima Training Center Military Reservation. Those driving on Interstate 82 can briefly see the collection of buildings surrounded by large white satellite dishes. The Department of Interior has issued a final environmental impact statement recommending that four Klamath River dams in southern Oregon and northern California be breached to restore salmon runs. The final EIS appeared yesterday on the Interior Department's website. On his way out of office, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is calling on Congress to appropriate $800 million to remove the four dams and perform restoration work, but the proposal has not gotten any traction. The proposal comes after tribes, farmers, and salmon fisher people signed a 2010 agreement on sharing Klamath Basin water resources in dry years and calling for removing the four dams to give salmon access to hundreds of miles of river habitat. PacifiCorp, The utility, which uses the power produced by the dams to provide power for 70,000 customers, said it would rather have the dams removed than pay for fish ladders to aid salmon passage. Klamath Tribal Council member Jeff Mitchell called for quick action on dam removal, saying his community is headed for, quote, a train wreck if action isn't taken. Salazar released a statement saying, once again, the communities of the Klamath Basin are facing a potentially difficult water year under a status quo that everyone agrees is broken. We need a comprehensive solution addressing all the needs of the Klamath Basin, including fisheries, agriculture, refuges, and power. Glenn Spain of the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations released a statement saying, this final report confirms that dam removal is both feasible and cheaper than any other option. None of the many scare stories spread by dam removal opponents were found to have any factual basis. Calgary-based journalist Andrew Nikiforuk spoke at Washington State University this morning about the impact of the tar sands on the planet and the new energy servitude on the planet. Nikiforuk, who is the author of a 2008 Canadian best-selling book called Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, was asked if forms of energy other than petroleum are competitive.
What the oil and gas industry is trying to do at this point in time is to create the illusion that it's business as usual, when in fact the quality of our resources that are the source of our cheap energy has dramatically and fundamentally changed. And that's where the real con is being played out. And as a result, then we don't have a conversation then about a shift. We need to make a shift before we no longer have any money left, because we've spent it all enriching oil and gas companies, mining the dirtiest resources left on the planet.
That was Canadian journalist Andrew Nikiforuk speaking at Washington State University this morning. Nikiforuk's latest book is The Energy of Slaves, Oil and the New Servitude. The Washington State Liquor Control Board announced Wednesday it will prohibit bars from allowing cannabis use on premises. The announcement came after Governor Jay Inslee complained to the board about reports of two bars in the state that were allowing marijuana use. In a board statement, Liquor Control Board spokesperson Brian Smith said, public use of cannabis is a civil infraction punishable by a $103 fine. Smith wrote, you can't open it up, you can't show somebody, and you certainly can't smoke it or ingest it in some way in a public place. Bars and restaurants are public places that we license. Washington Initiative 502, legalizing marijuana for recreational use for adults over 21 years old, was passed by the Washington voters last November. The legislation allows home use but does not allow cannabis smokers to use the product in any public venue, whether it is a restaurant or drinking establishment. Two Washington bars were allowing pot use. Frankie's Sports Bar in Olympia had a private smoking room where people could use tobacco or cannabis, thereby avoiding Initiative 502's stipulation against public use of marijuana. The Stonegate Bar in Tacoma only allowed patrons to use vaporizers to consume cannabis, which gets around Washington's rules against smoking in public places. Vaporizing heats cannabis to a certain temperature to release THC, but no combustion takes place, so smoke is not produced. Referring to Initiative 502, the Inslee administration said in a statement last week, Washingtonians did not vote for a wide-open policy. Currently, the law is written banning pot distribution by anyone other than a licensed seller. No licenses have been issued yet, and none will be until the end of the year at the earliest. The legalized recreational cannabis law applies to the statewide ban on indoor public smoking of any kind. Board Enforcement Chief Justin Nordhorn told the Seattle Times there is, quote, a loophole in the law that doesn't allow the board to hold licensees accountable for such activity. The board has not issued any citations for the bars that were allowing cannabis use. A federal jury awarded a group of Pullman firefighters more than $1 million in damages Tuesday in an employment discrimination lawsuit against the city. Jurors found the city of Pullman unlawfully retaliated against the five firefighters during the 2009 sexual harassment investigation of Captain Eric Reber. The firefighters had defended Reber when a female firefighter made the sexual harassment allegations against him. The firefighters said they believed the allegations were retaliatory against Reber because he had expressed concerns about an inappropriate relationship between a firefighter and a superior. The firefighters accused the city of ordering them to participate in the investigation of Reber, and they said their answers during interrogations were used against them. The city also investigated the firefighters to determine if their remarks were intended as retaliatory against Reber's accusers. The jury awarded $325,800 to Reber and $135,000 each to Rudy Fisher, Christopher Volk, John Galnick, Jason Wilkins, and Christopher Weyrung. Pullman Mayor Glenn Johnson said city officials were surprised by the jury's verdict, and the Washington City's Insurance Authority will cover the costs, meaning city finances will not be directly affected by the award. The Idaho Transportation Department says it is ready to review about 350 public comments about their draft environmental impact statement for their plan to widen U.S. Highway 95 for the 6.5 miles immediately south of Moscow to Thorn Creek Road. Some of the comments were made in oral testimony at the January 23rd public hearing at the university in Best Western, while others were submitted in written form during a public comment period that ended March 25th. The Idaho Transportation Department's draft environmental impact statement, which declared the eastern alignment over Paradise Ridge as their preferred alternative for the highway expansion, was released December 28th. The draft EIS also considers a central alignment that closely follows the current route of U.S. Highway 95 and a western route closer to the Washington state line. Public comments were solicited for all three proposed routes. ITD project manager Ken Helm told the Daily News the comments could influence the final route choice. Helm said a final environmental impact statement could be issued by August. Under that timetable, the final draft environmental impact statement would be published in the Federal Register in October, starting a 30-day public comment period. Helm said no matter which route is selected, the Transportation Department expects the project to be completed by 2016. The Idaho Transportation Department has set aside $40 million from its fiscal year 2015 budget for construction. The final cost of the four-lane divided highway is expected to be between $43 million and $48 million. Gritman Medical Center has committed to leasing space in the Martin Wellness Center to the Palouse chapter of Family Promise for a day center. Family Promise is a nationwide nonprofit housing organization where churches take turns providing food and shelter to homeless low-income families in an attempt to get them back on their feet. Gritman sent the chapter a memorandum of understanding Wednesday, committing to the lease arrangement, but details have not yet been worked out. The day center is to be used by clients to shower, do laundry, and have access to computers. Those looking for work will be able to use the day center's address on job application forms. Family Promise has secured 13 local host congregations. Interfaith Housing Network Palouse Chapter President Bruce Pittman told the Daily News he is optimistic the program will start up by summer. Idaho tax revenues for March are 4.4% higher than predicted by the Division of Financial Management. Idaho's surplus so far this year is $22.6 million, which is 1.2% more than the Idaho government agency predicted. Idaho lawmakers drafted fewer bills this year than in the last 40 years. The Legislative Services Office says 777 bills were drafted. Nearly 50% of those became law, which is the highest percentage ever. Normally, about one-third of the bills drafted become law. The legislature had the highest number of new members for a single year this year, with 41 people elected to either the Senate or the House for the first time. The report says the high percentage of bills passed, quote, seems to suggest that the legislature had a focused and limited agenda by design, and bill proposals were better thought out to begin with and well designed to address the issue at hand. Republican Governor C.L. Butch Otter says his bill creating a state-run health insurance exchange was the most important. Otter is also taking credit for the partial repeal of the personal property tax on business equipment, although the lobby group, the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, was pushing for a nearly complete repeal of the $141 million tax. Lawmakers did not want the revenue stream to dry up too quickly and approved a bill repealing $20 million of the tax. Under the new law, the first $100,000 in personal business property would be exempt, meaning only the largest businesses in the state would have to pay the tax. Democratic State Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow issued an op-ed today saying the legislature failed to complete its work because it did not approve Medicaid expansion. I spoke with Schmidt this afternoon about the issue and other issues that came up during the 2013 legislative session, which ended yesterday. It seems to me that your biggest regret of this legislative session is the failure to expand Medicaid. Tell me what happened. Didn't you introduce a bill?
What happened was we spent way too long on the insurance exchange issue, and that took a lot of energy and enthusiasm out of the majority party. There was a lot of emotion and angst about anything having to do with Obamacare, and it took a lot longer than we expected. I didn't introduce a bill yet. You know the Idaho legislature, and you know the ratio of majority to minority, and majority senator who actually is, excuse me, representative who is very conservative, Tom Lercher, who introduced a bill, and he introduced two bills because the expanding Medicaid has to be tied to getting rid of our catastrophic care fund, and Idaho is unique in the whole United States in terms of how we provide care for the uninsured or the indigent. Our constitution tells us, and then our statutes say the counties are responsible. So every year the counties pay for people who can't afford. They show up in the emergency room after a car wreck, or they walk in gravely ill, and they get care. And then the hospitals and the doctors present the bill to the county. And the county commissioners look at it, determine whether the patient is indigent, and the definition of indigent is they can't afford to pay for this, and then the county pays. There are some ways in which the county can has been able counties have been able to through statute control these costs a little bit, but not real effectively. And last year, that cost, if you add up all the counties in the state of Idaho, that was around $40 million.
Okay. Explain briefly how expanding Medicaid coverage works and why it would be cheaper to replace the state-county program for indigent care with expanded Medicaid coverage.
Well, the group that would be covered are the people who are below 138% of the federal poverty level. And we've studied the folks who get indigent care, and that's who gets it. And so it is just, plus, with the Affordable Care Act, it's going to be the individual mandate has been held constitutional, and everybody's going to have to have insurance. And so now the requirement that Medicaid be covered or that states expand Medicaid to this population through the Supreme Court decision was made optional. So this group may not have coverage.
And if
states choose not to. And then Idaho's still going to be on the hook for those medical bills. If Idaho chose to expand Medicaid, then those people would be covered under Medicaid and not the county taxpayers' property tax and not the general fund of the state of Idaho. I told you $40 million from county property tax. It's $35 million from the general fund every year. So we're talking around $60 to $70 million a year for indigent health care in the state of Idaho.
Besides saving the counties and states money, this is also a program expanding Medicaid that would insure people and therefore make it so less people wait until their medical needs become so acute that they have to go to the emergency room. Isn't that correct?
Well, the whole concept, if you think of the concept of the catastrophic care or indigent care, you know, you're right. They wait till they're, you know, severely ill. And I got to tell you, I sit on the CAP board and I read these cases, and it's tragic. A 50-year-old guy with 6 months of feeling sick walks in and he gets told he has terminal cancer, and we pay the bill for the next 6 months of his life. And if he would have been able to see a doctor, you know, walk in to a doctor's office and the doc could have convinced him to stop smoking or, you know, do something that would have intervened in a more appropriate fashion instead of caring for what is in essence a tragedy, providing appropriate care. I'm a family physician. I believe that's the right way to go. So I think we have an opportunity to do the right thing here, and it's pretty awesome. It's pretty uncommon to be able to do the right thing and save money, and I think we can do that.
It sounds like this expanded Medicaid could save hundreds of lives in Idaho if it was.
The estimates are more than that. I think the estimate was 500, because there'd be around 100,000 people would be covered, and you do the. I talked to a guy from Southeast Idaho who'd done the math on this population, and if you provide primary care to a population, you can just roll it out, and the number of lives. It's been studied in three different states that did this previously, because you know Medicaid is a program that's a federal program, and some states have chosen to expand coverage to 200% of the federal poverty level, and they did that. You know, 5-10 years ago, and you compare their populations to the states where it's not covered, and they're healthier. that's encouraging.
So, are you calling for a special session to deal with this, or too late?
Lee, you understand the politics in this state, and that's like you have to understand I told you, Tom Lurcher, he's a real conservative guy, but he stood up and said, "This makes sense for Idaho." And I got to tell you, that's how I was working this session. I talked to every senator I could, and the process is to persuade. And if I were to stand up as a Democrat and beat my drum in about this one, I think over time people would just stop listening. And my goal with this has been to get people to listen to the common sense of it in the appropriate way. And so you got to communicate that in a way that they can hear it. And if they can't hear it, they aren't persuaded. So it's just kind of a... it's a philosophy and a, you know, calling for things. And I tried to respect the governor's priorities of getting the exchange done, and I didn't you know, raise much of a fuss early on, but as that drug on, I started to get impatient and started talking. And I don't know, the worry I have, so the maximum benefit for the state of Idaho occurs soon as, or starting January 2014. That's when the clock starts ticking on the Affordable Care Act. And if, you know, the Idaho legislature won't start up until after that, and I don't know if the state's ready to do something before that, and we cannot without a legislative action. So it'll be up to the governor. The governor's the only one who can call for a special session. I doubt that he will. I've met with some folks today, and I don't think that's in the works.
And so you think people should gear up for the 2014 session if they want to push this issue?
Well, that's why I sent that piece out. It's because it's something we've just spent a year or 2 years talking about whether we should have a state-based or a federally-based insurance exchange. We got to start talking, and we got to get people thinking about whether this is the right choice for Idaho. And I have my opinion, but we need the state to think about this. And the other fear I have is that as politically charged as the exchange decision was for the session this time, next year is an election year. And folks who have to face a conservative challenge in their primary may not be so willing to take a risk. I know two senators who voted for the exchange who were censured by their Republican Central Committees in their counties for that vote. And can you imagine then voting for Medicaid expansion and going back and in primary? And that's the worry I have, is that we missed our opportunity this legislative session. And for every, but did I tell you, for every 6 months we put it off, we lose $45 million.
No. Okay. I know you're short on time. I was wondering if you had any observations on other issues from this legislative session that just ended.
Well, you know,
there's a
you
lot.
Saw the the education bills that kept coming back, and you know, Proposition 1 didn't get fully reconstituted, but it got plumped up, and that was disappointing. I thought that was unwise on the legislature's part, and I voted against most of those bills. Some of them were, you know, the open meetings. My opponent, and I heard Representative Agidius say she was opposed to Proposition 1 because she thought there should be open meetings. Well, everybody can agree on that, and that bill passed pretty easy. We all voted for it, but there were a lot of others that had to do with the negotiations between the school board and the teachers that I thought were pretty heavy-handed.
Yeah, 1 year limit on contracts and being able to unilaterally impose pay reductions.
Yeah.
Okay. So then the U.S. 95 extra heavy truck bill, the ITD does not have.
That wasn't just U.S. 95, Lee. That's a lot of roads. Highway 12. It's in essence wherever the Department of Transportation designates it's okay. And.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke there. But on roads such as U.S. 95 and U.S. 12, the ITD will not have to do public hearings as the law passed, although the signing statement from Governor Otter recommended that. It seems like the public hearings are only required for local jurisdictions when there are small roads that they want to expand for the big trucks. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right. The law was not a friendly law, it seemed to me. And I voted against it. There were a few episodes this time when it seemed to me like the legislature wasn't listening.
Now, as a legislator, is there anything you can tell us about the U.S. 95 widening project and route choice that the Idaho Transportation Department's going through for the 6 miles south of Moscow? Now, I realize it wasn't the subject of any legislation per se this year, but you may know something or have some information that you might want to share on that.
I really don't. I have been paying attention, but I don't think I have any more than what you have, so...
Any final comments about this session?
I went into it wondering just what my fellow legislators, because, you know, there was an election in November, and two things happened. Propositions 1, 2, and 3 all, you know, went down, and voters said clearly they didn't like what the legislature did. But at the same time, every legislator who was running, who voted for those, got reelected. And I wondered, it seemed to me some of the legislators sensed that and were kind of what I considered appropriately reluctant to head down that path of not listening to the voters, but some of them were, and that was what I took into the session, and I came out of it going, I hope the voters are paying attention.
That was Idaho Senator Dan Schmidt of Moscow speaking to KRFP from Boise this afternoon as he wraps up business before returning to Moscow. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and public affairs shows, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website, krfp.org, or radiofreemoscow.com to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow, and check our Indiegogo website out, which is collecting money for our Full Power campaign. Jim Roach and Patrick McLaughlin contributed to tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a great weekend.
KRFP, Moscow is the best in the USA.
Yeah.